This is an audiobook presentation of Public Enemy Zero by Andrew Main. Public Enemy Zero is available for only $1 at the Amazon Kindle store or via the Kindle app on all major tablets and smartphones, including iPads, iPhones, Blackberries, Windows 7, and Android. It's also available on the Barnes & Noble Nook store and Apple's iBooks. Or you can get a complete, uninterrupted copy of this audiobook at andrewmain.com/books. Chapter 18. Mitch pushed one earbud into his ear. He left the other ones open to listen for anything suspicious. He half expected the station to have switched over to a full-time talk format, dealing with the mall events like they did on 9/11. Thankfully, no. The station was playing its normal afternoon lunchtime mix of 80s pop. For a moment, Mitchell felt a sense of calm and normalcy of it. New Order's Blue Monday was playing. He listened to the song a little bit longer than a man on the run should have, but he could feel his heart stop beating so fast. He flipped the dial over to AM, went to the local news station. In his mind, he expected to hear someone say, "In other news," and then go right to talking about the mall. But they didn't. It was a car commercial, then a commercial for a life insurance company, and a commercial for an accident attorney. Bet that guy had a boner right now, thought Mitch. Finally, the station's afternoon newsreader came on. "We've got an update on the incident at Park Square Mall. The fire department has said that it wasn't a fire that caused the evacuation." Evacuation? Was that what they were calling it right now? "We're getting more reports that a riot took place inside the mall and led to a chase of the person who instigated it." Was that a riot or an attempted massacre? Instigator? They didn't understand. Although official numbers haven't been released, news helicopters on the scene have spotted what looked like at least 6 bodies on the outside of the mall. It's not clear yet if they fell from the roof, as some people reported, or if they were injured inside the mall or outside in some other manner. 6 bodies. That was just on the outside. He'd heard the sounds of them as he ran. He knew a lot more people were hurt than that. 7, 10, 20. Lots of people died because he ran. Mitchell's knuckles were beginning to whiten as he squeezed the radio. He switched hands before he cracked the plastic. Should he have just stayed there in the food court? If he had known then what he knew now, would he have just sat there and let them get him? Part of him thought that would have been the moral thing to do. Sacrifice himself so that other people wouldn't be hurt. He thought about the bloodshot eyes looking at him from the food court. The horrific way people stretched their hands out at him and bared their teeth. The shrill screams. The rage. Could he have sat still for that? It was one thing to put on a blindfold and take a bullet or have a doctor administer a lethal dose. Those things were quick. But what would it be like to be scratched and bitten till you lost so much blood your heart gave out? He knew the crowd wouldn't have wasted any time killing him, but it would have been an agonizing death. No matter the moral calculation of his pain versus those of others, nothing could make him want to go down like that. He'd die for someone else, but not like that. Not that way. The newsreader was still talking. "Police have told us that they'll be making a statement in approximately a half an hour from now. We're hearing that they may have a person of interest they'd like to speak to." Fuck. In other news, an area man is wanted for questioning in the assault of a parking enforcement official and 2 other people. Double fuck. Police would like to speak to Mitchell Roberts, who was last seen on foot near the scene of the altercation. Trifecta fuck. They had his name. Of course they had his name, from what happened with the parking officer. They had his damn car, they had Rachel and Rick, they had everything about him at this point. Everything except that he was also the person of interest at the mall. Person of interest. Such a silly way to say guilty without saying it. No one had any doubt what made that person so interesting. At this point, it was reasonable to assume that there was some kind of low-level manhunt, an APB, out for him for what happened that morning. If it weren't for the mall, that would have been the story of the day. Fortunately for his pursuers, he'd created one horrific distraction. In the news, it was a distraction they were still trying to pull bodies from. Once they connected him to that, everything would escalate. He'd become a really fucking interesting person at that point. It wasn't just cops waiting for him at his apartment or workplace. It'd be people looking for him at train stations and airports. When they talk to the old lady whose car he took, they throw the license plate and car make up on every electronic sign on the highway. Every cop would have his face on the computer screen in their cars. Unofficial reports from Park Square Mall are coming in, and the Department of Homeland Security officials are on the scene. Officials are downplaying that this was a terrorism-related incident, but haven't ruled it out just yet. As we pointed out earlier, police are expected to give us an update in 30 minutes. Terrorism? Holy Christ! Had he just gone from fugitive of the day to Unabomber or DC sniper status? Was he in Osama bin Laden's league now? Mitch shut off the radio. He checked back later to find out what he knew. For the moment, he needed to get proactive. He looked around the empty house. He couldn't stay. He also needed to figure out how exactly he was going to go into hiding. Right now, he was on the run. Full-on hiding meant he had to spend days and weeks without getting caught. That meant survival, food, shelter, and ways to protect himself. In the house, it was only a matter of time before either the police found it through Mike at the radio station or someone else came to check up on it. It was also totally empty of food. He could make a day or two without eating, but after that, he knew he'd get weak and make stupid decisions. He looked at his backpack. He had his iPad, radio, comics, some notebooks, a charger, and another shirt. Is there anything else in the house? Remember the door to the attic in the garage. Went back and pulled the ladder down and climbed up. Found a light switch and turned it on. There were boxes of Christmas decorations, luggage, and a box of old clothes. He took the box down from the attic to rummage through it. Pulled out all the men's clothing. Went back to the master bathroom. He didn't have to try on the pants to know they were too small. There was a golf shirt and a pair of shorts that fit. He also found a blazer and a golf cap. A pair of cleated shoes were going to be useless unless he wanted to hide out on a golf course and play the back nine, thought Mitch. Mitch put on the blue golf shirt. He decided to wear it instead of the t-shirt he had in his bag. It made him look slightly less like a person of interest in his mind. The more upper middle class he could look, the better. He decided to shove the blazer and shorts into his bag. He couldn't remember ever seeing a manhunt from a helicopter the bad guy ran away in a suit jacket. In a pinch, he could throw the jacket on and look slightly different. That might be the difference between getting stopped and making a clean getaway. To make a getaway, he needed to know where to get. He wanted to turn on his iPad and just pull up Google Maps, see if anything came to mind. The risk of having it give up his position, though, was too great. The car in the garage. Old people still use maps. Mitchell ran back to the car and opened the glove compartment. It was filled with pill bottles. He started to throw them on the floor, but decided he should see what was in them. If he got an infection or some other injury, he wasn't going to be visiting a pharmacy anytime soon. Most of the bottles were for various old age conditions. He did find a bottle of painkillers. Those could be helpful. He didn't want to take them with him and add junkie medication thief to his growing rap sheet. A new survival could mean the difference between being able to keep moving despite pain and being crippled by it. The pill bottle was mostly full. He looked back at the label. Beatrice Stein. Mitchell stared at it for a moment. Beatrice, with her bright red hair and gnashing teeth, was the first person he consciously did something wrong to unprovoked. It was one thing to try and stop people from chasing you. It was another to take an innocent person's car. Mitch put the bottle in his pocket. Roles were reversed, and he'd pulled into that parking lot and seen her running. He'd given her his car if he knew that she was seconds away from being torn apart. Under the bottles, he found three maps. One was for South Florida. The others were for the entire state of Georgia. He put the others back in the box, and then put the boxes back in the attic. The less it looked like he had been there, the better. Mitchell walked back into the living room and gathered all of his stuff back into his backpack. He needed to be ready to go in an instant. He opened up the map of South Florida and laid it on the floor. He sat down over it and looked at it in the sunlight, filtering through the Venetian blinds. It was just a piece of paper. But looking, it was like God looking down to earth. It gave him a sense of control. He could imagine a miniature Mitch and miniature pursuers trying to capture him. As long as he knew where he was going, he could be one step ahead of them. It was a fucking board game. Rather than be some loser who tried to rob a cashier and was shocked at how fast the cops caught up with him and had to make a pathetic attempt to run, he'd be a mastermind and plot this out like a heist. He looked around the floor and noticed a dime near the impression where the couch had been. He traced the map and located where the house he was in was and placed the dime there. Mitchell looked around the map. How could he get that dime as far away as possible, as safely as he could? Chapter 19. Simmons and Rios bandaged up people who needed less immediate attention, while paramedics worked on the more seriously injured. They moved through the crowd and helped out wherever the fire captain pointed to them. Mostly, they were there to reassure people. Rios watched as Simmons went from person to person and gently prodded them for information. She sprayed disinfectant on scratches and found pillows for sprains and bruises. It wasn't an official questioning, just her way of getting some facts and trying to understand what happened. Rios sat down and leaned against the checkout counter next to where Simmons was wrapping a woman's ankle. He hadn't trusted himself to ask questions in that situation outside of an official capacity. Sooner or later, his supervisor would come to them and tell them what to look for. Till then, he just told people they were working on it and did what he could. Simmons finished taping up the woman's ankle and leaned back against the counter next to him. The entire second floor was a mixture of wounded laying on mattresses pulled from displays and storerooms, stretchers, and emergency personnel trying to make sure the living were being taken care of. She brushed a lock of dark hair out of her eye and readjusted the scrunchie holding her ponytail. Every situation is different. I know that, but this is just really odd. She shifted a little closer to Rios. This many people? I get that they're still in shock, but with this many people, you'd expect a lot of different stories. People should be begging to tell you something. Not here. They seem to be just as baffled as we do.
What are they saying? They know how they got up here?
Some of them. Some of them say they were trying to catch up with him. When I ask who he is, they don't know. They just say they felt threatened and they felt attacked.
Rios looked at the turned-over displays and wrecked merchandise. Well, I don't think he did this by himself.
Simmons shook her head. No. No, he didn't.
She pointed toward a middle-aged Hispanic woman leaning against a bed frame. She was wearing jeans and a blue blouse. She was looking at something in her hand that wasn't taped up. From where Rios was sitting, it looked like a chain to a crucifix.
A few people like her, mostly religious, say they weren't chasing after a man. They were chasing after the devil.
The devil? Repeated Rios.
Simmons pointed out a heavyset girl with too much eye makeup crying next to a shelf full of towels.
She said the same thing. She pointed out an elderly man in slacks and dress shirt leaning against a mirror. He said Satan. Crazy, I know.
Rios remembered something in the back of his mind.
My grandmother was from Chile. Before she died, she told me a story. I guess because she was too afraid to tell her priest. She thought a cop was second best. I know, it's a stretch. She was from a real small town. They were very poor. To get to the market, they had to rely on one man who had a truck, Mr. Carlos. Anyway, she said Mr. Carlos was a mean man who used to take advantage of the fact that he was the only one in the village with a truck. He'd make them pay more money than they could afford. He once refused to take an old woman to the hospital because she didn't have any money for gasoline. The town hated him, but they needed him. He was more important than the mayor, who only had a horse. One day, a young girl was coming back from visiting her cousins in the next town. She was a pretty girl and sang very beautifully in the church choir. My grandmother said they wished that she could be that girl because they knew some rich man would come to marry her and move her away to a big house with an automobile. Mr. Carlos sees the girl walking on the road. He offers her a ride, but she refuses because she has no money. He says that was okay. It would be a free ride. So she got in. Nothing with that man was free. He drove her a little further, then forced himself on her. He then left her on the side of the road and drove back to town. He went to the one bar in town. My grandmother says it was just two tables and a man there with a bottle of whiskey, and he sits there, gloating. The girl got home, she told her mother. Her mother ran out to the bar and confronted the man. He just sat there and laughed and waved the keys to his truck. Soon, the whole town gathered. When the girl came out to get her mother, they saw her ripped clothes and her tears. They knew. Mr. Carlos held up the key to his truck and laughed at them all. "What are you going to do about it?" he asked them. A woman threw a rock. It hit the glass of whiskey. He laughed at them all. Then, without a word, all of the women and the man ran to attack him. They attacked him with their fists, their teeth. My grandmother said they tore the man to pieces. There was nothing left that looked like a man to bury. He was just a little girl, but she says she was part of it. I asked her how could she have been part of it. This was the one woman in my family that never hit me. She said it was easy. Mr. Carlos was the devil. To her and the rest of the town, they weren't killing a man who had raped a little girl. They were sending the devil back to hell. That's what God wanted. When I asked her if she wanted to talk to a priest for forgiveness, she told me no. She didn't need forgiveness for putting the devil back in his place in hell. She just wanted to know that, like me, the policeman, she'd seen evil. She'd seen the face of the devil. Rios looked across the room at the dead and confused injured covered in the blood of the people around him. Between you and me, does this look like the work of a man or the work of the devil? He asked. Simmons shook her head. It looks like the work of a lot of angry, scared people, Rios. She looked at their faces. People more scared by what they saw inside themselves. Simmons' cell phone began to vibrate. She answered it, then hung up. She stood up and dusted off her slacks. Brooks in the security office. They got someone to pull the mall security footage. He wants us downstairs. The security office had a wall of 20 screens showing different parts of the mall, centered around one large screen. When Rios and Simmons got there, the office already had a dozen people inside and a dozen more looking in through the glass. Rios didn't recognize most of them. He looked around and saw state and federal ID badges from various departments. A detective from the police department, Jeff Oliver, was operating the control board. On the larger screen, they were looking at footage of people running down the main corridor of the mall. Although he couldn't make out individual expressions, the first thing Rios noticed was the posture of the people. This wasn't a crowd running away from something. This was a crowd chasing someone. Their hands were outstretched. Their fingers curled into claws. Detective Oliver spoke up. The department store footage is on its own system. Someone bringing these drives down here. This is the sequence for now. I can show you different camera angles for some of the shots. He pressed a button. On the large screen, they saw an overhead shot of the food court. Toward the lower right, they could see the back of a man's head. He was seated at the farthest point away from the main area. From out of frame on the upper right side of the screen, they saw a woman running in the direction of the man. The tables and chairs prevented her from making a straight line, but they only slowed her down a little bit. Rios thought she looked angry as hell. "Watch this," said Oliver. He pointed to a spot in front of the seated man. A chair came skidding out and towards the woman. She tripped over it. The man jumped to his feet. "Now you can see the crowd react to what happens." All of the people in the food court turned to the man and began running toward him. The detective changed to another view. From that angle, Rios could see the man running from the crowd and push an older man over as he tried to block the exit. He clicked another button. A wide shot of the atrium, showing the man running towards a group of women. in the department store, then changing directions. The kiosk gets knocked over. The man ran out of frame. In the next shot, the man was running down the main corridor as more people started chasing him. The next camera, looking toward the atrium, showed him knocking over displays and throwing things in the path of people behind him. If assaulting a woman and the elderly isn't enough, check out this one. He clicks another button. The screen showed a man running toward a group of teenagers and knocking down a young girl to get through them. On the last camera angle, the man ran into the department store, and the entire mall followed him in. "So what caused this panic?" Oliver had a rhetorical tone to his voice. He pressed another button. "How about mob justice?" On screen, they saw a video of a furious child screaming at the man, rocking its high chair back and forth. Oliver turned to the people watching the screens. "Some asshole starts yelling at a kid. The mother comes running and he knocks her down with a chair. He takes off and the rest of the mall decides to catch him. The guy keeps knocking people down and the crowd only gets more angry." The detective leaned back in his chair with a smug look. "There is your devil," whispered Rios. Simmons wasn't convinced. Technically, everything the detective said was true, but it just didn't feel that way. That wasn't a crowd that wanted to catch somebody. They had bloodlust. She spoke up. "Can you show the part right before he kicked the chair at the woman?" Oliver nodded and pressed a button. Rios looked at the screen and tried to see what Simmons was looking for. All he saw was the man kick the chair at the woman. "You want another angle?" asked Oliver. Simmons shook her head. "Forget the chair and the woman. Roll it back before she ran. Now look at the screen and tell me at what point the crowd turns on the guy." Rios saw it too. The crowd was already beginning to move toward the man. Throwing the chair at the woman may have tipped them over, but they were already focused on him. "All right," said the detective. "They saw him yelling at the kid." He pressed another button. For the first time, they got a good look at the man from the front as he stood at the end of the food court. Several tables away from the child was having a fit. To Rios, it didn't look like the crowd even noticed the child. They were looking at the man. "Can you go back to when he sat down?" asked Simmons. Oliver clicked another button. On screen, they saw a man hurry into the food court and stare into space. The mother spilled a drink and ran to go get napkins. The man looked at his phone, but otherwise just sat there. The child stared, screaming, and then the man finally looked over at him, but she never said anything. He looked away when the mother came running and kicked the chair toward her. "I don't see him yelling," said Simmons. Brooks spoke up. He was still wearing the blood-stained shirt. "Whether or not he instigated this, he didn't handle it in an appropriate manner, and we need to speak to him." He paused. "A lot of people were hurt today because of him, and someone has to answer for that." Brooks turned to the room. "Do we have any leads yet?" Rios finally stood up. "His name is Mitchell Roberts. He's our guy from the assault on the parking officer earlier today." He reached into his pocket for the photo on his phone he'd gotten off Rachel's Facebook. He handed it to Simmons. Simmons looked at the photo and nodded. "Well, that makes things interesting." "Looks like we have a one-man rampage here," said Oliver. "Let's bring him in," said Brooks. "Assaulting on an officer, and now this? Let's put everyone we can on getting him sooner than later." Chapter 20. It took 20 minutes from the time Detective Brooks said it was a priority that they find Mitchell Roberts to when a uniformed police officer walked through the doors of WQXD, where he worked. Meanwhile, other uniformed police were showing up at his apartment and back at Rachel's house. Unmarked cars were parking further out from his apartment to see if he came in by foot. Since it was normal business hours for the station, most of the daytime staff was still there. The station manager, Philip Dunlop, left his office in a hurry to meet the officer at the front desk. The afternoon news producer had already put an item on his desk about a person of interest with the same name as their late-night host. Odd, he thought. He'd always imagined that when the police came for one of his hosts, it would have been Rookman. "Mr. Dunlap?" asked the officer. "What can I do for you?" he answered, although already had a pretty good idea of what this was about.
We're trying to locate one of your employees, a Mitchell Franklin Roberts. Does he work here?
Not anymore, thought Dunlap. One host fighting a cocaine rap was enough.
Yeah, he's our nighttime host on the weekdays. Would you like his home address?
The officer looked down at his notebook.
Is it 1221 Pass Ave, apartment 32?
Dunlap turned to the receptionist, who was sitting at a desk next to a fake plant.
Kayla, could you check on that?
The dark-skinned young woman, who was listening attentively, pulled up Mitchell's contact information on her computer.
That's it.
Do you have any other contact information for him?
Dunlap shook his head.
I don't really know him that well. Let me see who else here that might know him. Kayla, could you page Mike?
Kayla called for an intern on her desk phone and then offered up.
I know he was apartment hunting a couple weeks ago.
The officer wrote that down.
Is he friends with anybody here at the station who he might try to go to for help?
Like I said, I don't really know him, to be honest. He's a bit of a loner, said Dunlap. The officer wrote down, loner. Dunlap regretted calling Mitchell a loner. He'd written enough news items to know what kind of context people always put on that term.
He did have a girlfriend, said Kayla. Pretty girl.
The officer referred to his notes.
Yeah, looks like he beat her up pretty bad.
Kayla made a face.
Mitchell? Are you sure you got the right guy?
She asked with a high-pitched tone. The officer ignored the question. Mike the intern walked in, saw the police officer, and almost pissed himself.
Are you Mike? Asked the officer.
Yes.
I just want to ask you a couple questions about Mitchell Roberts. Do you have any idea where he might be?
Mike's normally blank face went blanker.
His house?
The officer shook his head.
Besides there, is there any other place he might go? A friend he trusts? Families that live in the area?
Not that I'm aware of. When he broke up with his girlfriend, he didn't have any place to stay.
You think he might try to contact you? Asked the officer.
Gosh, I don't think so. I don't know him really well. He's a nice guy and all.
The officer pulled some business cards from his chest pocket.
Some detectives will be coming by to ask you some more questions. In the meantime, if anything comes to mind, you can call us here.
He gave a card to each of them and walked toward the door. Mike looked down at the card.
Sure thing. I hope Mitch isn't in trouble. He's a good guy and all. When his girlfriend broke up with him, I tried to help him find a place to stay.
Pardon me? Asked the officer as he turned away from the door. This is an audiobook presentation of Public Enemy Zero by Andrew Main. Public Enemy Zero is available for only $1 at the Amazon Kindle store or via the Kindle app on all major tablets and smartphones, including iPads, iPhones, Blackberries, Windows 7, and Android. It's also available on the Barnes & Noble Nook Store and Apple's iBooks. Or you can get a complete, uninterrupted copy of this audiobook at andrewmain.com/books.